Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Joan Knows. Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, brings us a bird's eye view of the Vatican Week. But first, Jill Bevilacqua brings us the next in her series of reflections on the Sunday Gospel by the intriguing title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, which begins, as always, with Sean Patrick Lovett reading this week's Gospel for us.
Some Sadducees came forward, the ones who claim there is no resurrection, to pose this problem to Jesus. Master, Moses prescribed that if a man's brother dies, leaving a wife and no child, the brother should marry the widow and raise posterity to his brother. Now, there were seven brothers. The first one married and died childless. Next, the second brother married the widow, then the third, and so on. All seven died without leaving her any children. Finally, the widow herself died. At the resurrection, whose wife will she be? Remember, seven married her. Jesus said to them, "The children of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those judged worthy of a place in the age to come and a resurrection from the dead do not. They become like angels and are no longer liable to death. Sons of the resurrection, they are sons of God. Moses, in the passage about the bush, showed that the dead rise again when he called the Lord the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. All are alive for him."
In the days immediately preceding our Lord's passion, his enemies are all at him, asking catch questions in the hope that he will fall into the trap. He has just silenced the Pharisees, who have asked him if it were lawful to pay tribute to Caesar, when along come a group of Sadducees, the men of the establishment, the wealthy aristocracy, but more importantly, men of power. For they had total control of the temple, and they also knew how to handle the Romans, their overlords. Sadducees and Pharisees were usually at daggers drawn, but they've recently become allies in a common aim, to get rid of Jesus of Nazareth. When he raised Lazarus from the dead, the Sadducees suddenly saw him as dangerous, a threat to their power. If the Romans saw the people flocking to him, they might decide to destroy the temple, destroy the Jewish nation. And so the high priest Caiaphas made the celebrated prophecy, "It is better for one man to die for the people than for the whole nation to be destroyed." The decision is unanimous, and the die is cast. But meanwhile, there is perverse amusement to be had by taunting the future victim with seemingly impossible questions. Unlike the Pharisees, the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection of the body and the immortality of the soul. For the first five books of the Old Testament, the books of Moses, said precious little about either. And these were the only books they felt bound by. They believed in God, but they were basically men of the world. Not so was the man from whom they took their name, Zadok, who was high priest 1,000 years earlier under David and then Solomon. Zadok, in fact, with Nathan the prophet, played a decisive role in securing the throne for Solomon after David's death. For centuries, the descendants of Zadok held the priesthood. In time, this line had ceased, but the name was still used for the priestly aristocracy, the group of families from whom the high priest was usually chosen, and other rich and noble families who intermarried with them. After the destruction of the temple in AD 70, the Sadducees disappeared without trace. In the October of 1727, George II was crowned King of England in Westminster Abbey. And the German composer who'd become a naturalised British citizen, George Frederick Handel, composed four magnificent anthems for the occasion. To this day, the first of these, Zadok the Priest, is performed in the Abbey for the coronation of each new English monarch.
Oh,
And so to the question posed by the Sadducees to Jesus. As usual, they based themselves on Mosaic law, which in this case was designed to secure the continuance of the family and the stability of family possessions. If a married man died without a male heir, his brother had to marry the widow, and any sons born of this union had to bear the name and inherit the possessions of the first husband. But in the story the Sadducees recounted, the woman married 7 brothers, one after another, and died at last, having produced not a single heir. If there were such a thing as resurrection, whose wife would she be? But Jesus was ready for the Sadducees and had his answer, as we read in Matthew.
You understand neither the scriptures nor the power of God. For at the resurrection men and women do not marry. No, they are like the angels in heaven. And as for the resurrection of the dead, have you never read what God himself said to you? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God is God, not of the dead, but of the living.
In the book of Exodus, in fact, when God speaks to Moses from the burning bush, he says just what we've quoted. And by that, our Lord concludes, he means that these men are alive and that their bodies are destined for resurrection. And no wonder, then, that as Matthew put it, his teaching made a deep impression on the people who heard it. And let's listen now to one of the most famous of John Donne's holy sonnets on the Christian's attitude to death.
Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou thinkest thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. From rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, much pleasure then from thee, much more must flow, and soonest our best men with thee do go, rest of their bones and souls' delivery. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men, and dost with poison, war, and sickness dwell, and poppy or charms can make us sleep as well, and better than thy stroke. Thy swell'st thou then, one short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die.
There are a number of plants symbolic of resurrection and immortality. For those of us who live in Italy, cypress trees in the little cemeteries outside each country town or in the great city cemeteries are a very familiar sight. Cypress wood is almost everlasting. The great cypress gates of Constantinople lasted for 1,100 years. Thus, it was associated with everlasting life after death. Hearses were wreathed in cypress and coffins made from the wood. In England, the yew tree is often seen in a churchyard, for it too is slow-growing and very long-lived, another symbol of immortality. It's been said that a post of yew will outlast a post of iron. Laurel, too, has symbolic significance. The Romans crowned both victorious generals and athletes with laurel garlands. Christians are reminded by laurel of the victory of Christ over sin and death. In his letter to the Romans, St. Paul writes,
"We believe that having died with Christ, we shall return to life with him. Christ, as we know, having been raised from the dead, will never die again. Death has no power over him any more. Death shall no more have dominion over him."
The Welsh poet Dylan Thomas was preoccupied with death all his short life. So it was not surprising that he should write a poem entitled "And Death Shall Have No Dominion." But shortly before he died, he wrote a poem to celebrate his 35th birthday. And although it speaks of approaching death, it's more of a celebration of life and has been called his most triumphant poem. This was what he called his last blessing.
that the closer I move to death, one man through his sundered hulks, the louder the sun blooms and the tusked, ramshackling sea exults. I hear the bouncing hills grow larked and greener at berry-brown fall, and the dew-larks sing taller than thunderclap spring, and how more spanned with angels ride the man-souled fiery islands, O, holier than their eyes, and my shining men no more alone as I sail out to die.
Lebanese poet Khalil Gibran echoes these joyous sentiments and adds his own.
You would know the secret of death, but how shall you find it unless you seek it in the heart of life? The owl whose night-bound eyes are blind unto the day cannot unveil the mystery of light. If you would indeed behold the spirit of death, open your heart wide unto the body of life. For life and death are one, even as the river and the sea are one. In the depth of your hopes and desires lies your silent knowledge of the beyond, and like seeds dreaming beneath the snow, your heart dreams of spring. Trust the dreams, for in them is hidden the gate to eternity. And when you have reached the mountaintop, then you shall begin to climb. And when the earth shall claim your limbs, then shall you truly dance. And what is it to cease breathing, but to free the breath from its restless tides, that it may rise and expand and seek God unencumbered? Only when you drink from the river of silence shall you indeed sing.
But there is probably no more powerful exposition of the resurrection of the body than that of St. Paul in his first letter to the Corinthians, or more stirring a musical version than that in Handel's Messiah.
The trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this perishable nature must put on the imperishable, and this mortal nature must put on immortality. When this perishable nature has put on imperishability, and when this mortal nature has put on immortality, then the words of Scripture will come true. Death is swallowed up in victory. Death, where is your victory? Death, where is your sting?
And let's close with an extract from Dylan Thomas's poem, "And Death Shall Have No Dominion."
And death shall have no dominion. Under the windings of the sea, they lying long shall not die windily. Twisting on racks when sinews give way, strapped to a wheel, yet they shall not break. Faith in their hands shall snap in two, and the unicorn evils run them through. Split all ends up, they shan't crack, and death shall have no dominion. And death shall have no dominion. No more may gulls cry at their ears, or waves break loud on the seashores. Where blew a flower, may a flower no more lift its head to the blows of the rain. And death shall have no dominion.
were listening there to Jill Bevilacqua. She'll be back again at this same time next week. Meanwhile, time to join Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, who's about to bring us the Vatican Week in review. Joan, welcome back.
Here we are, November, and last weekend, the beginning of November. Friday was a holiday last week, the Feast of All, the Solemnity of All Saints, and the Holy Father actually
left the Vatican.
He resumed a tradition that had been started by Pope John Paul II, and he went to Verano Cemetery in Rome to say Mass in the late afternoon Saturday, the Feast of All Souls. The Holy Father did go into the Vatican Grottoes to pray before the tombs of the Supreme Pontiffs, and that's more or less a private moment. It may have a secretary or two and a cameraman or two, but other than that, it's basically a private moment. It's interesting about the grottoes. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have been there. If I counted correctly, there are the tombs of 19 popes in the actual grotto area of the Vatican Basilica. And there's also many cardinals buried there and members of royal families, which often surprises visitors. You have, for example, Queen Charlotte of Cyprus. I'm not that familiar with Cyprus's history, but obviously at one time they had royalty. And Queen Christina of Sweden, and then some of the Stuarts are also buried there. And then on Sunday, the typical Angelus, no other big papal celebration on Sunday. That was the interesting story of Zacchaeus, and he's a tax collector in Jericho, and he's a very short man. He's also very despised because he's a tax collector. Nothing has changed in 2,000 years, right. So in order to be able to see Jesus, who's supposed to be just passing through Jericho, he climbs up a tree. Actually, the gospel story talks about, you know, his conversion. He meets Jesus, and Jesus says, I'd like to spend some time at your house. And from there on in, history changes a little bit, certainly for Zacchaeus. But, you know, I thought the Holy Father's words were so beautiful. There's no profession or social condition, no sin or crime that will cancel from the memory of the heart of God even one of his children. And this just is a thread we have seen since the first day of Francis's papacy. At towards the end of his remarks, because the Pope always reflects on the gospel of the day during the Angelus, and the Pope said, if you have a burden on your conscience, if you're ashamed of things you've done, just stop a moment. Don't be afraid. Someone's waiting for you. And then, I love these words. He said, climb like Zacchaeus did. Climb the tree of the wish to be forgiven. You know, some little phrases just get kind of seared into your mind and heart when the Pope says them. On Monday, there was a Mass in St. Peter's, presided over, of course, by Pope Francis, in remembrance of all the prelates, the cardinals and bishops who had died in the previous 12 months. Pope said this is obviously always a fitting time to remember the pontiffs because we are the early part of the month celebrating All Souls and All Saints. Other than that, Monday was pretty quiet, but Tuesday there were two things, the big document, but also the announcement by the Vatican that the nunciature in Syria had been hit by a mortar.
Unfortunately, no one was hurt.
The nuncio, right, Archbishop Mario Zanari, did say it hit at 6:35 in the morning. The employees had not yet come to work, although it did strike a part of the building near the residence bedroom area of the Archbishop, his secretary, and the nuns. But anyway, the other big news of Tuesday, of course, was this document, the presentation of the preparatory document for the 2014 Synod on the Family questionnaire. 9 questions with some sub-questions totaling 38 or something like that has been sent to all the bishops of the world, and they are to get input. These are questions not up for a vote, which is how a lot of the media did present the questionnaire. Everything's going to be based on doctrine, not on public opinion. So these are issues to be looked at. And what they're looking for answers is, how do we as church, how do we as pastors respond to these? How do we help people who are in unusual marriage situations, etc.? So it's more to help the priests and the bishops look for a pastoral ministry to help people in XYZ circumstances. And the synod's in, what, like 11 months as we speak, and it's a two-week synod, October 5.
It's an extraordinary, synod,
October 5 to 19. And there will be a lot of lay participation in this synod. The Holy Father, we've heard all these months of his papacy, has stressed the importance of the role of the laity in the church. And even right here in Rome, at the Roman Curia, the role of women. He's mentioned a theology of women, but I'm not sure there's even anybody in the Curia other than the Holy Father who can expand on his words and meaning. What does he mean, theology? You're going to write a document or what?
Well, and that takes us to Wednesday, when the Pope meets
all the faithful of the world. And
in St. Peter Square, of course.
You know what was so amazing about Wednesday? The Pope continued his catechesis. He's been talking about the Creed and the one holy Catholic Apostolic Church. He's talked about those. And this is his second week talking about the communion of saints. But just to digress for a minute, perhaps there were really two outstanding moments in the audience that weren't exactly related to the Pope's catechesis, except in talking about the communion of saints. He always has three ways of looking at a topic that he focuses on. One of these was charity relative to the community of saints. And then he kind of left his text for a minute. He says, by the way, folks, can I ask you for a favor of charity? And then he laughed and he says, no, I'm not going to ask for a collection. And he said he met before the audience the parents of a little 1.5-year-old girl. I think her name is Naomi. She's very, very ill. I can't remember as we speak the name of the disease she has. The parents have been praying, madly for her recovery, and the Pope prayed for her and apparently blessed the little girl. And he said to the 50,000 faithful in St. Peter's Square, now, Naomi is she's baptized. She's a Christian just like all of us. And I want to ask you all to pray silently for her health and recovery. And then together we'll say the Hail Mary. Well, let me tell you, this silence fell over St. Peter's Square. 50,000 people silent for like a minute. And then the Pope led them in the Hail Mary. So those are the touching moments. Of course, the catechesis, the teaching is always important. But that was a very special moment, I thought, of Thursday. And then there is still a photograph that has gone viral. A man has a disease, which I can't pronounce well. A man has a disease that has caused his entire face and head to have boils on it. It is not contagious, but it does obviously turn people off because this man's physical aspect is not pleasing, of course. And the Pope went right over and put his hand on him and embraced this man. And that photograph has totally, totally gone viral. So it was an amazing day for the Pope to show love and mercy to the people that probably in life don't often get it.
And he continued his catechesis on the Creed apart from that, no?
Yes. Oh, yes, he certainly did. And then all the language summaries of his Creed, which except for the Spanish, and since May, the Holy Father has been speaking Spanish in public, but the other languages are always summarized by an official of the Secretariat of State, and so Portuguese, French, English, whatever. And then the Pope reads it in Italian, what that person has said. He greets the groups and so forth. So the typical Wednesday audience of the Pope going around in the white jeep and greeting people and kissing babies and et cetera, et cetera. He does that for like a half an hour. So, because I have people walking by my house. I'm 3 blocks from St. Peter's Square. They're walking by at 10 o'clock. And I'm going, if you're going to the papal audience, of course you think it starts at 10:30. His catechesis does. But if you want to see him going around the square, you got to be in there early. Wednesdays are always kind of fun. You really kind of want to stay home, though, and not be in St. Peter's Square unless you're intending to go to the papal audience. But so Thursday,
the Beatitudes.
They were featured because the Vatican announced that Pope Francis has chosen the themes for the next 3 World Youth Days. So it's going to be a 3-year itinerary of spiritual preparation, which will culminate in the World Youth Day in Krakow, Poland in July of 2016. And we know the Pope announced Krakow when he was in Rio for this year's World Youth Day. And All three themes are taken from the Beatitudes. And it's interesting because the Pope did say in Rio, he told the young people, he said, read the Beatitudes again. They will give you an action plan for your lives. He said to them, look, read the Beatitudes. That will do you good. And so 2014 is Blessed are the Poor in Spirit. Theirs is the Kingdom of Heaven. The 30th World Youth Day a year later is Blessed are the Pure in Heart. They will see God. And then the culminating International World Youth Day, because the previous two are at a diocesan level every year on Palm Sunday. So the 31st World Youth Day in Krakow is Blessed
the
are
next one, in a sense.
The next international, right. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. So
of course, there's the Shrine of Divine Mercy in Krakow.
Heavenly Days,
Waganiki.
Yes. Divine Mercy ever since John Paul has become a staple in Catholic life and prayers, and the Divine Mercy chaplet recited at 3 every afternoon for those who follow the tradition.
And of course, this year on Divine Mercy Sunday, Pope John Paul will be canonized.
Yes, well, Divine Mercy Sunday, right, the Sunday after Easter, April 27th, 2014. So a fairly busy week for the Pope. It was a busier weekend than week itself. There was a lot of Vatican news, but Fridays are often reserved, and I think it was Pope Benedict who kind of started this. He said that he would receive heads of state and government on Fridays and Saturdays. He wanted to well distribute, even at the beginning of his pontificate. You know, he's saying to himself, I'm 78, let me kind of look at my schedule. And so by limiting receiving heads of state to Thursday and Friday, except for anybody whose visit was already on the agenda, and Pope Francis seems to be trying to do that, receive them on maybe Fridays and Saturdays, Thursdays and Fridays, or sometimes after an audience. He will go after a Wednesday general audience to a small hall in a small room of the Paul VI hall and meet a head of state or head of government.
And they have to wait a long time now because his audience never ends.
Yeah. It's just like it ends when I leave. There's no alarm going off and I have to, pull out of St. Peter's
Square.
He does
look at his watch from time to time, I noticed.
He does, but I don't think it concerns. It's just like to know the time, not to say, oh, dear, I've only got 4 more minutes,
I think you're right, Jen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and see you next week, then.
And with that, yes, indeed.
And our thanks there go to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we won't be back again at this same time tomorrow, but we will be back again at this same time next weekend. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.rv.va, and then click on the English World icon. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.